Hello, and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, managing editor at Town Hall, and today I'm joined by
Ash Scow, commentary writer for the Washington Examiner.
Yeah, thanks for coming on with me, Ash. Wanted to talk about a couple different things today, but mostly revolving around the Hobby Lobby decision that came out earlier this week. And I don't really want to get into some of the legal weeds here. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't feel qualified to discuss that. I would encourage everyone to read SCOTUS blog, which is not the official blog of the Supreme Court. They're an independent blog, which was much hilarity ensued when people on Twitter thought that SCOTUS blog was the real Supreme Court. And I'd also encourage people to read the Volokh conspiracy at the Washington Post, which has had a great legal breakdown of those issues. But I kind of wanted to talk more about some of the policy implications here. And on when the decision came out, you had a fairly scathing article with regard to the White House's response to the Hobby Lobby decision. And I wanted you to kind of walk me through that and where you think the White House has gone off the rails here.
Well, they had a kind of childish, if you want to use a PC term, for it, response to this, where they basically said they didn't agree with it, and they said that they would respect the laws, but look for ways to work with Congress to kind of fix this problem, this gap, or whatever that the Supreme Court decision created. And then White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest was then asked if Obama would take, you know, executive actions to deal with this. And Earnest said that, you know, we're not quite sure what we're going to do, and kind of left the door open to Obama just, you know, completely disregarding the Supreme Court and just going about his own way just because, you know, he's not happy with the decision, which is actually something they had done before, if you'll recall, with the Lilly Ledbetter Act. They didn't like the Supreme Court decision, so they basically, you know, had Congress pass a law to undo that or just circumvent it.
Right. And I think that the discussion over Obama's executive action is something that conservatives latched onto a lot here. It seems difficult to be able to come up with an executive action around this, or even, I mean, this was a law passed by Congress and a regulation enacted by HHS. It seems like it would be difficult to get around this part. And the decision was narrowly tailored, so it's not like there is going to be a rash of other exceptions that come down the pipeline. The Supreme Court kind of implied those are going to be on more of a case-by-case basis. But I wanted to ask you, you know, where... So the decision allows Hobby Lobby, the company, and Conestoga Wood not to cover certain kinds of birth control that they consider to be abortive fashions and kind of against their religion. Do you think that that is something that we're going to be seeing more of? I mean, because the Supreme Court did leave a door open saying, you know, there are legitimate religious responses to some of the HHS guidelines, and that it might be on a more case-by-case basis. Do you think that there's going to be some more challenges to this, and are we going to see more religious employers trying to drive that wedge open further?
Well, we might. I mean, there are, the left is correct in saying that they there are other cases out there where you know, other employers are trying to say that they find all birth control against their religion, which is a difficult, you know, a difficult case to be in. Because the Hobby Lobby, you know, as they know, you know, they provide 16 of the 20 FDA-approved birth control methods. They only didn't like four, which included IUDs and, you know, basically the morning after pill.
Drugs like Ella.
Right. Plan B, things like that. But there are cases pending, apparently, that there are other companies that are trying to ban all birth control because they find it all to be So we'll see where those end up. But at right now, there's just, because the Supreme Court decision was so narrowly decided, there's just not a lot of opening for other companies currently under this decision to go about banning whatever they like, you know, blood transfusions or any of the other arguments that liberals have brought up.
I want to take exception to what you just said. You just said other companies banning certain forms of birth control, which is kind of a major sticking point for conservatives here, is that there have been reactions saying, you know, Hobby Lobby's banning this form of birth control. This is a ban on the morning after pill, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what's going on here, and a lot of conservatives do take exception to that, that it's not about the companies banning these forms of birth control. It's about a non-provision of birth control in their health insurance contracts, right? Right. So it's not, I think that this language of prohibition, which is what a lot of progressives get kind of rally around, is that it is a form, that they claim it's a form of your employer preventing you from getting some of these medications, that's not what's going on here, and that kind of language does tend to muddy the debate.
Right, exactly. I mean, this isn't a ban. You have just as much access to birth control as you did before this provision was put into place, which, let's remember that this provision was put into place in 2012. So unless before that there was some, you know, horrific war on women issue where women couldn't get birth control and we were living in the dark ages, this really isn't, like, nothing's changed. You could still go get birth control. I mean, as you said, your employer cannot physically stop you under this decision from getting birth control. They just don't have to provide a health insurance plan that covers it, which just they weren't doing prior to 2012 anyway. I mean, this isn't like, liberals that are so upset about this, why weren't they upset prior to this provision being announced? Because before this provision was announced, you weren't constantly seeing people screaming for free birth control under their health insurance plans. I mean, it wasn't an issue. HHS came out with it, and then suddenly this is the civil rights fight of our era for women. I mean, it's completely absurd how off the rails they have gone in order to defend this provision. I mean, it's just out of bounds.
So here, I want to kind of try to work through this here. From my perspective, and this is for progressives, this is about the equalization of treatment of basically everyone for the provision of healthcare. And that's kind of what the promise of Obamacare was. Obamacare was about being able to basically the hugest goal was being able to treat people fairly who had pre-existing health conditions, right? And the argument is that just because you are born with a condition, or just because of who you are, and this is not related to things that are under people's control, but just to say, you know, we're trying to equalize the treatment of people who are unlucky in the genetic lottery and are preconditioned to or predisposed to having health conditions that are going to cost them a lot more money than people who are born predisposed to being perfectly healthy. And part of that is that women, just kind of by dint of being women, incur a lot more health costs over their lifetime than men. And I think I read a study that was done in the early 2000s that say women incur 33% more health costs over their lifetime than men do. And part of that, and that's in, you know, Western industrialized countries. And part of that is that women have longer life expectancies. So, you know, they live longer, and in your elder years, you incur more health costs. But part of that is, you know, a lot of pregnancy care, maternity care. And I would say that the argument goes that in modern society, we have the ability, and we should have the ability, to kind of enjoy a sexual life without consequence. And so part of that is paying for birth control. So the provision under Obamacare is trying to equalize the amount of health costs incurred by both men and women. And part of that is that, these health plans, the Obama administration says, should cover birth control. They should cover maternity care. They should cover all of the things that are what they consider to be normal health costs borne entirely by women and not by men. And that kind of payment and system should be equalized.
Right, and I understand that argument. It's just that, when you're having the whole birth control thing, I mean, birth control was already covered by plans. They were just paying for a copay on it. I mean, possibly $30 copay a month for it. So it's not like it wasn't covered at all. It's not like they were paying hundreds of dollars a month for it. And again, remember, these decisions only deal with health insurance plans. So if you don't have health insurance, then none of this applies to you anyway, because this is all within a health insurance plan. So I'm trying to say that it's trying to equalize the cost when the cost, it was already so little. I mean, it wasn't even, it's just, this is a thing. There's absolutely no subsidies for condoms
Right.
for men, So, I mean, I'm just,
Right. I would say that the certainly the reaction that you're describing seems disproportionate to the decision. But the decision seems to be, if we want to talk about quote unquote war on women, this decision seems to be a setback in, like what I was saying, the goal of Obamacare, which is to kind of equalize the payment of or the costs borne for health conditions between the sexes. And so it seems like a blow against that, and that's what people are upset about, not just the birth control. And even if it is, like you said, a pretty minor cost, all things considered, it does seem, at least it seems to be a blow against, the equalization of treatment of men and women under the law, which is Obamacare. And, Obamacare might be good or bad, but the point is that the overall goal of Obamacare is to equalize the payment between not just between the sexes, but between everyone.
right, but that's, I mean, that's assuming that everybody is equal in their medical care. I mean, as you said, women use more medical care, so you're just going to make things free for women. That's actually not equalizing things. It's making things unequal because it's supposed to be about the care, not the person. And so if you use more care, you pay more for it. So by giving certain women issues, birth control, by giving these things out for free, then you're actually making things unequal because then men are paying for their health care, like everything, because random parts of their health care are not being provided for free.
Right. Do you think that kind of the costs of birth control, maternity care, things that are unique health costs to women should be borne exclusively by women?
Well, if you're going through maternity care, I mean, don't you normally, not anymore in the society, the man should be there in some capacity. I mean, I guess that's a blow to single women who don't have someone there. But again, I don't see how you force a man who is not involved in the pregnancy whatsoever to bore the cost of it. You see, I mean,
Right.
as in
Well,
a
this.
coworker who is now paying higher premiums so that you get cheaper maternity care when maybe he doesn't even ever see you or know who you are.
Right. I mean, so theoretically, this is a good point. The and this is something that I wanted to bring up. The employer mandate itself caused this problem, right? If we had no employer mandate, there wouldn't be a minimum definition of insurance for employers. Religious employers wouldn't be upset about it, and these costs that, like you're talking about, that your co-employees are paying for your increased health costs, that wouldn't be a problem. And what I would say is, I would point to Obama's original promise, his if you like your health insurance, you can keep it promise, which he knew was a lie at the time. Everyone knew it was a lie at the time, but not enough people were pointing it out, and it turned out to be obviously false. But he said it. And so a partial goal of Obamacare was trying to make sure that as little disruption to the health insurance system as possible occurred. And the employer mandate was part of that, because without the employer mandate, companies are incentivized to drop people off of insurance plans. They're incentivized to cancel their insurance plans. They can say, "Oh, you'll go to the exchanges. The government will handle you there. The government will give you subsidies, and you'll be able to find a plan there, and it's not on us anymore." But the mandate was in there to try and make sure that companies wouldn't do that, because Obama promised people that they'd be able to keep their insurance. Now, if there was no employer mandate, companies could do that, and they could dump people onto the exchanges. And in the exchanges, the HHS has a lot more leeway legally to make these mandates of what minimum insurance you can buy are. So, this challenge to the Supreme Court only concerns employer-sponsored insurance. It doesn't concern the insurance you get on the exchanges. So, if they were to allow people to dump, or employers to dump people onto exchanges, on the exchanges, there are minimum standards for covering birth control. There are minimum standards for maternity care. There are minimum standards for all of these things. And those costs are borne in general by society, by taxpayers. So you don't run into that problem of your employer, your employees are paying for increased health costs. And this is kind of the overall goal of Obamacare, and to some extent would be the overall goal of a single payer system. And that's to make sure that the costs of health care, no matter who you are, no matter your risk levels, are borne by society at large, rather than by your employer, by your co-employees, etc.
Right. And for a lot of health conditions, maybe that's not a bad thing, I mean, maybe everybody should, as a society, help grow our society by caring for maternity and things like that. But then again, you get into the issues of now we're paying for people's health care for things that they've completely done to themselves, like paying for the health risks involved in obesity, things that are not generally just an accident to somebody who are, that's not generally just a hardship, like getting a cancer, unless most types of cancer. So it again just goes to that, like why should my taxes, and at this point, why am I paying twice for health insurance? I mean, if I'm paying my increased premiums for everyone at my office and for myself, and then my tax dollars are then going to help others, I'm essentially paying twice for all of this. And some of these things, I mean, again, I don't know why I should have to pay for a man's Viagra, I believe, or why should I have to pay for the diabetes treatment from someone who didn't eat properly?
And that actually plays into kind of what you were talking about with how your group of employees pays for insurance. One of the big objections that I saw raised by progressives is, well, Hobby Lobby pays for Viagra. Shouldn't people be upset about that? And what you would say, and what a lot of conservatives would say, and what I would probably say is, if you don't want to pay for your coworkers' Viagra, you don't have to work at Hobby Lobby. You can go work for someone else who, you look into their plan and you're not paying for Viagra. You can be self-employed, things like that. And, not everyone has that flexibility, but certainly, we don't subscribe to the theory that your boss is a taskmaster who you can't le ever leave. We're in favor of labor mobility among companies. We're in favor of companies competing for employees. So if you don't want to pay for your coworkers' Viagra, find a company that doesn't pay for your coworkers' Viagra.
Right, exactly. And when you do find out that they're paying for Viagra and not 4 kinds of birth control. Remember, they were paying for 16 kinds of birth control. So it's not like they're not paying for birth control and they're paying for Viagra. They're actually paying for both, just not
right
the morning after pill. But, I mean, that does get into the weeds. If a company, let's hypothetically say that a company was paying for Viagra, but not any form of birth control, you know, then there might be a cause for outrage because even though Viagra in some ways has been shown to help, you know, I think it helps arthritis patients or something. There's some offshoot that Viagra helps, but then you get into the weeds of, okay, well, birth control helps other things as well. So if a company were doing that, I could see the outrage, but that's not what's happening with Hobby Lobby because it's paying, it's providing coverage that pays for the pill and Viagra. That is that not equalizing?
Right.
That's equalizing, isn't it?
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you about another kind of result of the Hobby Lobby decision, and that's the prospect of making birth control and kind of a very wide variety of birth control available over the counter without a prescription. Your colleague Phil Klein wrote a piece about this, about how, you know, maybe the next step for conservatives here is to say, you know, we don't want you to be able to get birth control. We don't want employers to be forced by the government to provide birth control, but we do want to make it easier for women to get birth control. And maybe a step there is pushing for making it available widely over the counter. And I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that, because personally, I don't have experience with birth control, but I do know that a lot of different, you know, there are a lot of different forms. Like you said, there are 20 forms that we're talking about here, and all of them come with different benefits, different downsides, different side effects. And it seems to me like a lot of that is something that your doctor does need to be involved in. But I wanted to get your perspective on this kind of push for over-the-counter birth control.
Right. Well, I mean, some of these forms, the forms that are, you know, the take every day pill seems like a no-brainer. Like, I mean, the morning after pill is over the counter, so why shouldn't the most widely used forms of birth control be provided over the counter? Now, there are the forms, you know, you're saying that one of the ones that Hobby Lobby didn't want to provide coverage for was IUDs, which is something that, or IED, what are IUDs, I think, that's insert.
Yeah. IUDs, yes.
The other thing's a bomb, but that's inserted into you. So that, you know, it most likely can't be provided over the counter.
Right, that needs to be a medical procedure.
Yeah.
That needs to
and
be a medical
also,
procedure.
I believe the ones there's the shots under the arm might need to be more of a you between you and your doctor, but I really do believe that this could be a great step, that this would make it way easier for women to gain access to this pill by making it over the counter. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, you know, you have a prescription and you have the yearly physical that women have to go through, and they won't refill your prescription if you don't go through that. And yes, you should still go through that, but say that you just can't afford that procedure, that checkup at that month, but your birth control is going to run out. Being over the counter would make sure that you don't have any breaks in your birth control regimen. So making it over the counter, I can't see an argument against that. Maybe put, you know, for people who don't want 13-year-olds to go get it, possibly putting some sort of age limitation on it. But again, some girls start birth control when they're young for, you know, acne and things like that. So I don't know what the age would be, but that could be a part of the discussion.
Right. Yeah. So maybe, like you said, put an age limit on what you can buy over the counter at drugstores, pharmacies,
etc. Have a parent's signature under that or something like that.
Right. So there are ways around that. But you do think, just to sum up here, you do think that, you know, a push for over-the-counter birth control might be something that I do think that the conservative movement can get behind that. I mean, there are a lot of, to put it, very mildly, there are a lot of people who think that the revolutionized sexual mores of our modern society are should be rolled back a little bit, and that making birth control available over the counter without a prescription, making it easier to have it beyond what employers currently sponsor, would be kind of a step back for some social conservatives in that area.
No, I understand that, and there would also be an outrage, but there, maybe I would get attacked for this, but there just comes a point when society is moving in one direction, and you, trying to stop it is now making people just, you're losing hearts and minds by not moving forward with what most of society deems, finds just fine. So, I mean, I know that there's going to be a lot of outrage if you suggest birth control be provided over the counter. Unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of outrage, and it's going to fire back on the right big time because it's going to be coming from the right. And you'll have the media out there saying, look at these intolerant people. They, you first you with the Hobby Lobby, and now you don't even want women to get it over the counter, which would be completely solve all the problems. So yes, you clearly are trying to restrict access. So, I mean, that's just how the argument's going to come across, whether once you nuance it, that's not the case, but that's just how it's going to come across to people. And so, you just got to think about that. I mean, think about the way that you approach these arguments. Because if you look like you're really against things that are happening in society that have become normal and become accepted, or things in society maybe aren't accepted but people don't talk about, and you're just totally out there against them, then you start to look really maybe not bigoted but just intolerant. And you need to think about that.
Not updated to kind of the standards of our more modern
Right.
society. Speaking of winning hearts and minds here, you've talked about, and you a lot of your writing focuses on how, so the left and progressives are pushing that conservatives are waging a quote unquote war on women. And you've written a lot about how some of the priorities there seem a little off because, in America right now, like we've been talking about, a lot of the progressive feminists are outraged that the Supreme Court ruled about birth control being provided by their employers, where there are some serious anti-feminist things happening in other countries that are not being focused on by the modern American feminist movement. And I wanted to kind of get your perspective on the outrage over the Hobby Lobby decision versus some of the other things that you've been writing about that you think are a more valuable use of our time.
Right. Well, while this Hobby Lobby thing has been going on, hundreds of women just in Pakistan have been murdered due to honor killings, which is basically you do something that your family believes has hurt its honor, say marrying without their consent. And so they'll kill you for it, and they'll get off because in under Pakistani law, you're allowed to forgive the accuser or forgive the murderer, and they'll basically be set free. And since these murderers are the family, a family member just has to forgive the other family member, and it's totally acceptable. You just go on with it. And meanwhile, in America, we're complaining about having to pay 10 to $30 for birth control a month. I mean, it's just there's just a lack of perspective. And then you think about in Saudi Arabia, women aren't even allowed to drive or get an education without a man saying that it's okay. And then you look at America and ban Bossy. I mean, there's just a severe lack of perspective over here. And then you have, in Nigeria, the schoolgirls that were kidnapped. So Michelle Obama and some celebrities come out with a hashtag that they quickly abandoned and forgot within the week. So it's like, oh yes, we care about women in other parts of the world. Oh, what was that? Can I say that somebody is in America, a Republican is waging a war on women? Oh, forget the Nigerian girls. That's basically how it happens. And it's really sad. And there are thousands upon thousands, millions of women in the world that are living under severe oppression. And American women don't even think about that. They don't care. They're focused on their first world problems. And it's really sad.
Right. I think hashtag activism is kind of a unique phenomenon that I don't know if we have enough time to get into right now. But certainly, it seems like, being in the online activist community, we see this kind of fad cause raise up every couple of weeks, every couple of months, and then disappear just as quickly. Like you said, the hashtag bring back our girls thing that never got solved, they're still in crisis over there, but it's just completely disappeared from Americans' radar. But here's, I guess, the counter argument is that there's really not much we can do to affect change on the level that you're talking about in other countries, whereas it might only be $10 to $30 a month, but maybe a bunch of people protesting at the Supreme Court would be enough to sway a judge's opinion, The it was widely reported that kind of Justice John Roberts was wavering up until the final day in the original Obamacare case. It might be the case that public pressure and public outcry do make a difference here, and it might just be a marginal difference. It might just be like you're talking about first world problems, but it might be more on balance, on net, that you can do with activism here in the United States versus activism about foreign countries.
Right. I mean that's always the argument, but again, I mean there's things that the US could do, through aid, lack of aid, threat of la aid, for these countries and putting out statements more that they don't agree with these things and for women here in America focusing their pressure on, putting pressure on these other countries and saying that, we don't agree with it. Now I know there might not be a whole lot that can happen, but the way that they're fighting the arguments here in America are making it seem as though these are the worst problems in the world for women. And that's just not true. And that's where you lose a lot of people because it looks like you're just whining about first world problems when there are people that are really suffering out there.
Right. I think that you're right that a certain amount of perspective is necessary. But in, hashtag activism, online activism, what matters is kind of either being really outraged or pretending that you're really outraged. Because saying, this problem, it's kind of an inconvenience, so let's do something about it, doesn't really rally people. It rallies people to say, this problem is a rollback of women's rights. Well, I think that's probably about all the time we have today. Thanks a lot for joining me, Ash. And I will see everyone next time on another episode of Rational Actors.